It was in 1994. The world was watching, but failed to act.
I believed at that time that I was doing my best. But I realized after the genocide that there was more that I could and should have done to sound the alarm and rally support.
Today, the country is still recovering from the impact of the genocide.
We saw what happened in Rwanda in 1994, and we know the horrific consequences when hate is allowed to prevail. Preventing history from repeating itself requires countering these hate-driven movements that have become a transnational threat.
Sessions of intolerance towards opposition and critics. In 19 years of its rule, the Rwandan Patriotic Front accused of enforcing arbitrary arrests, detentions, killings and torture against opponents.
Others are corrupt people in our new system who do not want to face the justice or to face what they have become.
Thank you for joining us today on our audio journey through Africa. My name is Nangam Sokwinana, and I'm delighted that you have tuned in again. In our previous episodes, we have visited South Africa and talked to Constitutional Court Judge Edwin Cameron. From there, we traveled to Zimbabwe, where we met Senator David Coulthard and Dumisani Muleya, international award-winning investigative journalist. We met Elizabeth Minde from Tanzania, Nicholas Opio, and Bobby Wine from Uganda, as well as Alouine Tin from Senegal, reporting on the situation in Mali. We also introduced you to human rights defenders in Cameroon, Nora Shuye and Alvis Wepengong. If you missed those episodes, do take a listen. Today we find ourselves in Rwanda. Rwanda, officially the Republic of Rwanda, is also known as the Land of a Thousand Hills. Rwanda shares borders with Uganda, Tanzania, Burundi, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. In 2017, President Paul Kagame was elected to a third 7-year term. According to official figures, he received 99% of the vote. As we already pointed out in previous episodes, even in democratic constitutional states, human rights violations occur on a regular basis. Emerging and developing countries, especially in Africa, are particularly affected. In Rwanda, significant human rights issues include serious restrictions on freedom of expression, with things like violence against journalists, censorship and website blocking, torture, acts of violence and criminalization on sexual orientation, substantial interference with the rights of peaceful assembly, and restrictions on political participation. I am very pleased that Louis Businje is joining us today. Louis is a human rights lawyer living in Rwanda. He has a master's degree in international human rights law from Lancaster University in the UK and a postgraduate degree in public international law from the Independent University of Kigali. He is an alumni of Uganda Christian University, where he graduated with a bachelor's degree in law. He currently serves as the strategic associate at Interconnected Justice, a pan-African organization that advocates for the dignity of African persons and heritage. Prior to his appointment, he was the program's coordinator at Human Rights First Rwanda Association, a national organization that promotes human rights and access to justice for marginalized persons in Rwanda. Just a note to our listeners that Louis is recording in Rwanda and outside his home due to lockdown restrictions currently in Rwanda, and as that is where the most stable internet connection is, so you may hear a bird or two tweeting in places. Thank you so much, Louis, for being our guest today. Louis, I was telling the audience that we are in Rwanda today. We recently celebrated Women's Day in South Africa. Rwanda has, or at least had, the highest representation of women in parliament in the world and is pursuing a strong gender equality political agenda. How did this come about?
I must begin by saying that it would be quite hard to separate what is happening in Rwanda without alluding to the social and economic political landscape that is strongly attached to what happened here in 1994. So a brief background of the atrocities that were committed then. As you probably well know, that the genocide against the Tutsi occurred, and this unfortunate occurrence utterly decimated the population, and unfortunately, most of the victims so happened to be men. Of the million people plus who perished in this genocide against the Tutsi, most of them being men, there happened to be a leadership gap that existed post the genocide. And this, of course, spurred more women to take up the leadership positions that existed within the civil service. And most women, I must say, during the genocide, were given the pedestal of having decision-making prowess within the homesteads as the genocide was taking place. So as most of them also played a pivotal role in the liberation struggle, they had this sense of wanting to use some of those skills within governance structures. And true to the word, as decency more or less tried to prevail within the country post the genocide, as the 2003 constitution was being promulgated, it was only natural that women took the lead and take up the mantle of responsibility within parliamentary roles that were there. Right now, as we speak, Rwanda leads the globe in as far as gender equity is concerned through parliamentary representation. Then in 2003, when the constitution was being promulgated, we had the quota system that expected 30% of them of parliamentarians to be women. But we actually had a higher number than was expected. So we had 56% of women who were elected or appointed as parliamentarians in both chambers of parliament, being the deputies and the senate. Today we have them at 62%, and Rwanda is leading in this front globally. I must say that this does not only stop at them being in parliament. It cuts across other sectors as well. In the private sector, we have an element of gender equity. I'd give the example of parastatals like the Rwanda Development Board. This is an institution that is mandated with promoting tourism and investment in the country. It's led by a woman. The national carrier, Rwanda Air, was only recently being led by a woman.
I have definitely often heard that women are extremely well promoted in the politics of Rwanda. I appreciate what you've just shared with us, because you've also expanded on the fact that it's not only within the politics of Rwanda that women are promoted, but also you do try your best as a country to promote the equality and the equity of women across all sectors. Thank you very much for sharing that with us, Louis. I do know that you've also traveled quite a lot and that you've also studied in the United Kingdom. Could you please share and reflect to us, how progressive do you think Rwanda is in terms of feminism compared to the other countries that you might have visited? How is feminism regarded in Rwanda?
To begin with, I'd say that it's in an ideal world. From the caring nature that women have, the pro-development, pro-nurturing, it's only right that a woman would lead any institution. And that is what Rwanda has been trying to promote, feminism, gender equity, and equality across the board. But I also must say this, that it wouldn't be fair at all to compare the context, not only in Rwanda and Africa, at large to democracies that have existed for centuries. The United Kingdom, as you rightly put it, has democracies that has been there for since time immemorial. But even then, they still have gaps, and they had gaps. I would allude to the fact that it's only in 1918 that women were given the right to electoral suffrage in the United Kingdom. That's just about a century ago. Seems fairly recent compared to the fact that the United Kingdom is one of the most progressive countries in the world. Rwanda has tried its best to adapt to feminism, regardless of the fact that there do exist some challenges. We see that, as I've mentioned, we have governing structures that encourage this, but from the bottom going up, we still have several gaps. I'll give examples on education and training, for example. Less and less girls access formal training, especially in early years of development. You find the ratio is not balanced. More boys attend school than girls. We have issues concerning sexual reproductive health rights. Of recent, we've had so much activism towards access to menstrual hygiene in favor of the girls, of course. The issue of poverty, it's also an underlying issue that seems not to be erased. But the main issue is this, in the context that we live in right now, Africa being the continent that it is, patriarchy seems to be the issue. And decision-making for women, especially in the households in rural areas, is yet to be achieved. That being said, people from different sectors, the civil society, lawyers, practitioners, and such, they try as best as they can to ensure that equality and equity prevails. Yeah? We have some policies like gender mainstreaming. I'll give the example of the land equity program that was centered to in 2011, where women and men have an equal share to the right of possessing land. And this goes a long way in empowering them to access, not only have decision-making capabilities in the homestead, but also access other financial institutions by giving loans and such. And this has been seen to try and spur women to take up some of this. It's a feminist approach that is being done at policy level. We have various activities that practitioners like me partake in. I'll give the example of the 16 days of activism that happens every November. People like me, who's a strong proponent of the he-for-she movement, go out and advocate against the ill effects of sexual gender-based violence. So to answer your question in a nutshell, feminism is something that is quite broad, and we try our best to make sure that, especially in the grassroots levels, women have a say in what affects them.
Indeed, we do appreciate the work that yourself and other women and men who are human rights defenders do in order to ensure the continued investment towards human rights, equality, and equity. Louis, as you've already touched on, I'm aware that you are a human rights lawyer. Could you share with us what motivated you to become a human rights defender and to stand up for the rights of others? What is your story?
My story is one that has a very sad beginning, because I was unfortunate enough, or fortunate, depending on how you look at it, to be born as a refugee. Again, alluding to the fact that this country was under turmoil in 1994. My parents gave birth to me and my siblings in a foreign land. I was born in Kenya. And this being so, at a very early age, I've had various incidents of discrimination perpetrated towards me and my family based on the fact that we were living in a foreign land.
this was an issue, something that not deter me, but inspired me to pursue means of addressing such challenges, especially for people who are vulnerable, as I was then. So me pursuing a career in human rights activism and using my profession in the legal field to try and create equity for everyone across the board has been something that was inculcated from my childhood. I must say this, that along the way I managed to gain experience and exposure, and also learned from people who have been working in this field for several years, and they've shaped my mind both academically and professionally. And to be honest, I stand on the shoulders of giants who inspire me to do the wonderful work, or to emulate the wonderful work that they've been doing in human rights.
Thank you for sharing your personal story with us, Louis. Now, we have already said at the outset that human rights violations are occurring all over the world. You are living in Rwanda. What do you think are the most serious human rights violations in Rwanda at the present moment?
If you look at human rights across the board, the social, economic, civil, political rights, there are many. And if I was to narrow it down to two freedoms that I think need to be addressed more, I would focus on the right to freedom of expression and access to information, as well as the freedom of the issue of pretrial detention. These are two issues that keep on recurring and seem not to be addressed adequately by the powers that be. So to begin with, the freedom of expression and access to information, this is a fundamental freedom that is provided for by the Constitution of the Republic of Rwanda under Article 38, that provides that everyone has the right to freely express him or herself without any encumbrances. There's also a law relating to access to information that was enacted in 2013 that empowers individuals, common citizens, to seek, receive or impart information that is within the framework of public interest within a timely manner. But then again, you find instances where the state or authorities or people who are supposed to relay the information broadening the exception to this rule. Of course, it's not an absolute rule. Internationally, there are some exceptions to freedom of expression. For example, one is not supposed to prejudice public order, good morals, or invade on personal family privacy. You find that, and also mention the fact that access to information also has its exceptions. It's not an absolute right, so to speak. Any information that would be seen to threaten national security or legal proceeding, or aim to reveal trade secrets, all these are exceptions to one accessing information and being availed the information as is required by law. But then again, these exceptions are supposed to be ideally interpreted in a narrow manner, but you find the people who are supposed to enforce or implement these freedoms apply them in a broad manner. They did not apply them in a narrow manner, and this has been seen to be an impediment to these rights actually being seen to be done. Something that has been also echoed by the Universal Periodic Review, the third cycle that happened this last year. 15 of the recommendations that were handed down to Rwanda, all of them touched this issue of access to information and freedom of expression in the country. where we had the Human Rights Council urging the country to, or the state to, ensure that media pluralism is seen. The independence of the media is something that is of utmost importance. You find the recommendations relating to the revision of provisions that are seen to undermine the freedom of expression and access to information. I'll give the example of the cybersecurity law that has been used to target online bloggers and people who somehow seem to be critical to the state. You'd have the law relating to data protection as well that is tabled before parliament. You find that all these laws seem to undermine the general rule that the principle that access to information and freedom of expression is a right that is entitled to everyone. Touching on pretrial detention very quickly, this is provided for by the Criminal Procedure Act. And to explain to the listeners what pretrial detention is, this is an incident where a scenario where a suspect is kept under confinement or detention before conviction or before he or she is tried. And this has been seen to be an issue because most of the cases, there's pretrial detentions go way beyond the scope that is provided by law.
There's also one thing that I'd like to find out. Sadly, homosexuality is considered a taboo topic in Rwanda, even though neither homosexuality nor homosexual acts are illegal. Rwanda is a signatory of the United Nations joint statement condemning violence against the LGBTQ people. How is it possible that homosexuality has such a negative position in Rwanda's society?
This is something that I'm also very passionate about. LGBTI rights in Rwanda are not criminal de jure, but de facto, there are very many incidents of discrimination and homophobia. To put this issue into context, about 12 years ago in 2009, there were suggestions that this is the LGBTIQ community to be punished based on the fact that the misconception that it is an African or does not promote African values. And due to the word, the draft penal code then, 2009, had a draconian article that set to punish anyone who's seen to be practicing or engaging in same-sex relations and such, or even people who encourage or sensitize to a sentence that exceeds 10 years. But through collective lobbying by human rights practitioners, lawyers, activists, and such, journalists, that particular article was deleted. And indeed, it was seen as a victory then. And it's still being celebrated now because of the 54 African states. I think Rwanda is one of the few that has no criminal stance against the LGBTI activities. I'll allude to the fact that Ghana just only recently tabled a bill criminating LGBTIQ activities. Ghana has been praised to be the godfather of democracy and equality in the continent. But these draconian laws seem to be taking effect in even the most progressive states. Then again, I must say this, that the true Rwanda is a signatory to the UN joint statement that condemns violence against LGBTIQ persons. And same thing with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948. But these statements are just commitments by nations that set standards towards human rights or the prevalence of human rights. There's nothing that binds them towards it. And this is reflective to the homophobic tendencies that are being seen on the ground, because as we speak, there are so many cases of homophobia, violence, there's a lot of hate speech online. There's very many instances of discrimination, both within the family setting and the society, that seems to target people of sexual minorities, people who, or even people who are of varying gender identities.
And Louis, while we are on that thought of there has to be more that has to be done, could you reflect to us, what do you think is the role of the churches? And also, what do you think is the role of proper quality education? What do the churches and what does proper quality education play as a role in this field?
To begin with, let's take a moment to reflect on what African culture is. And as we've come to realize that African culture is one that celebrates diversity and uniqueness. And this has been seen through the various philosophical approaches that our historical fathers relied upon. I'll allude to Ubuntuism in South Africa. We had humanism in Zambia. We had the philosophy of Harambe in Kenya, also in the East African region at large, I must say. But with the onset of colonialism and Christianity that came in the 18th and 17th century, heteronormativity and same-sex relations were seen to be evil through the eyes of the Christian faith or such. So the role of the church should be one that aims to preach love, unity, hope, inclusion, and such. Yet to see a church that relies itself on the doctrine of hate and negativity, as is seen. Contrary to what is believed, it's a church that came with the notion of homophobia. These criminal stances that we see in today's legislation are a true reflection of what the Christian faith brought. And this is something that needs to change in order for there to be positive attitude towards the LGBTIQ community. The role of education is one that is quite broad. One of the things that scholars that are pro-LGBTIQ equality profess is that LGBTIQ persons or existence is the issue that is not repugnant to African norms. I'll give the example of one famous scholar, Dr. Sylvia Tamale, who has given an anthropological account of the existence of LGBTIQ communities historically within the African continent. And she alludes to various factors like the king of Buganda at the time was known to be gay. She alluded to the fact of the Bushmen of Gruave in Zimbabwe, who also had members of different or varying sexual orientations or gender identities. And more to this is how the societies adopted or inculcated them without any form of discrimination whatsoever. This is something that needs to be inculcated in today's education, where it needs to be progressive. For lawyers who study human rights like myself, the principle of universality as a countermeasure towards cultural relativism is something that can be included in the syllabus, pro-LGBTIQ rights, of course. I think this is something that needs to be inculcated as well. There are also other philosophers who come up with theories like intersectionality and identity politics that looks at how people with varying identities can actually forge that identity to create equity for themselves. This is something that also can be used to improve their curriculum, so to speak.
Certainly, the content that you've shared with us has been quite intriguing and engaging, but mostly very insightful. And as we are nearing towards concluding our engagement, I do want to find out from you. Only recently was the Persons with Disability policy adopted in Rwanda. Could you please explain to us, what does this entail?
I must say that the issue of persons with disability is something that I'm quite sentimental about. And to also give a brief context on disability rights in Rwanda, we have the constitution that lays down fundamental freedoms that protect persons with disability. We have Article 16, for example, that prohibits any form of discrimination upon people with a physical or mental disability. We have the law relating to persons with disability that was enacted in 2007. And we also have various institutional frameworks that also advocates for the rights of persons with disability. We have the National Council of Disability. This is a national body that advocates for rights of people with disability across the board. We also have a member of parliament who represents the legislative formulation process, pro-PWDs, sitting member of parliament. But then again, this framework, both institutional and legal, was seen to be acting within a vacuum, so to speak. The most recent census placed persons with disability at about 6% of the population. So about 500,000 of Rwandans are actually persons with disability. And these laws did not address one thing, that disability is a diverse concept. You'd have other forms of categories of disabilities that were not well catered for within these particular laws or frameworks that were seen to be trying to create equality for persons with disability. And this is one of the things that this policy seeks to address. I'll give the example of B2 people, for example. They were historically not considered to be persons with disability, and this is one of the things that this policy addresses. People living with albinism, people with autism, cerebral palsy, and Down syndrome, all these are catered for well within the policy. And in all honesty, when you look at the policy itself, it seems to even reflect more of the intention of the law than the law itself. And it sets to operationalize some of these laws by triggering the non-discrimination clause fully. It sets to also diversify the responsibilities for prevailing of PWD rights. Historically, traditionally, we'd have the Ministry of Local Government, for example, that was in charge or had the docket of ensuring persons with disabilities' rights were ensured. But now this policy seems to diversify that. We have the Ministry of Finance that is given the onus of budgeting, of having inclusive budgeting. We have the Ministry of Sports and Culture, for example, as well, that seems to have the mandate of promoting sports and culture that is inclusive. We now have the Paralympics that are set to begin, and this is seen to be one of the avenues that the Ministry of Sport can use this policy to encourage persons with disability to participate in sports. All these are brilliant strategies that are presented in this policy. It's only right for us to harness the intention of this policy. I'll also allude to the fact that the law did not also provide for other social amenities, for example, health, poverty reduction strategies, employment for persons with disability. But this policy seems to provide, for example, accessible forms of education as a right entitled for students with disability. It's a very sad fact that 68% of children with disability cannot access school much as they want to access school. And this accessible means by the use of technology and assistive devices is something that is provided for by this policy. So I think it's a wonderful thing, and it's being tried and tested. As I say, it's only a month into existence, and we hope to see that equality and equity for persons with disability will thrive moving forward.
Thank you once again, Louis. And as we near the end of our engagement, I think let's end this one on a positive note and also hear some of your personal aspirations. What is your dream or vision for human rights in Rwanda and perhaps even in Africa in general?
Of course, human rights is something that is evolving. I must say this, that the African context is one that is blessed with so much diversity, so much beauty, and people from different cultures, walks of life, the social strata. And it's a sad thing to see that the people who are mandated with the responsibility of making this world or this continent a better place are the ones who seem not to be respecting, violating the rights of the common being. Now, my dream, my ideal world would to have responsible members of the community taking up these leadership positions and fulfilling their mandates as required by law, not even by law, by the human nature, you know, promoting the dignity of the human person. You know, it's a concept that is not Western. This is a concept that is not just African. It's a human concept, the dignity of the human person through equality, through non-discrimination, to the respect of the rule of law. These are things that I would ideally want to see. Those people in power should look towards themselves as human beings and try as much as possible to create a dignified society amongst African citizens.
And I'm confident, Louis, you will definitely be amongst those that are at the forefront of continuing to defend and protect human rights, not only in your own country, Rwanda, but in Africa in general. Thank you very much for sharing interesting and also educational insights with us and our listeners. We really do appreciate all the knowledge that you've shared with us. Thank you, Louis. I really enjoyed that conversation with Louis, and it was interesting to hear how Rwanda has been evolving since 1994. Some things that really stood out for me in our conversations were the government's policy on promotion of women in decision-making roles and the fact that 62% of National Assembly representatives are women. It is interesting to hear how this has had a trickle-down effect in other sectors of society, including business. Women are in leadership roles where they are able to effect real change. I was also touched to hear Louis's personal account of how he ended up being a human rights lawyer and how his early life and being born a refugee impacted his decision to devote his life to fighting for human rights. Now, although Rwanda has its human rights issues, from Louis's reflections, it seems that there has been progress in the area of transformation in Rwanda. This was our Rwanda episode of Let's Talk Human Rights, the FNF Africa podcast exploring human rights issues. If you enjoyed the podcast, join us for our next episode. The Friedrich Naumann Foundation Sub-Sahara Africa is an independent German organization that is committed to promote liberal ideals and politics in Africa, such as human rights, the rule of law, democracy, innovation, digitalization, and free trade. By conducting campaigns, media events, seminars, workshops, study tours, cultural happenings, and training courses, the foundation promotes human rights, including freedom of expression, freedom of the press, children's rights, as well as LGBTQI+ rights, and engages against violence against women and capital punishment. If you are interested in our activities, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Simply search for Freedom Foundation Africa.